Hello, I'm Roger Channon, and welcome to the first podcast of 2021. We're almost coming up on a year of episodes. How exciting is that? I hope everybody is doing well and staying healthy, and I have a very exciting episode planned for today. With me here today is Jaipal Singh. He is the founder of one of Cincinnati's newest firms, Chatrik Architecture and Urban Design. Although a relatively recent startup, Chatrik is quickly growing, and even during these difficult times. And I am confident that in no time at all, everybody will know the Chatrik Architecture name, and we will see some amazing and inspiring architectural creations popping up around the Cincinnati area as a result of Jaipal and his amazing team. And welcome, Jaipal. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much, Roger. Pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you. So let's start with you and your background. I'd love to know where you're from and how you became interested in architecture.
Born and raised in Liberty Township, my friend. Went to Lakota, Cincinnati native. I even scored a touchdown in the old Riverfront Stadium as a kid. Went to Washington University for architecture school in St. Louis. And after that, worked in St. Louis for a little bit. Went to New Haven, worked in Connecticut for a little bit. Got most of my training and solid experience up in Connecticut with some serious architects up there. And then had the pleasure of traveling the world a little bit with my master's degree as well. Before, after 12 years away, I landed back in Cincinnati. Interestingly enough, my grandfather was actually a master builder. The story is he traveled from India to find work when he was 13 years old, and he jumped on a boat with his uncle over to East Africa, where the British, who had recently colonized India, were now colonizing Africa and developing that. And so they were using the workforce of the trained Indians to help develop the railways and the infrastructure over in East Africa. And so it was a great job opportunity, aside from all the other sort of hidden agendas with colonialism. But for the family, it was a really great job opportunity. And my grandfather and his uncle, you actually had to be 16 to jump on one of those boats. And so they forged some papers and got themselves through. He was only 13. They landed in Mombasa, Kenya, and made their way slowly to Nairobi, the center, the capital city of Kenya. And for at least the first 6 months or so, they were trying to find work. And the plan was to work with the railway. And every day they would walk for miles to reach a job site by sunrise. And they would, the foreman on the job site would line all of the potential workers up and kind of just choose people at random. And so you either got chose to work for the day or you didn't. You had to go home. And sometimes it was cold and rainy and muddy and all that sort of stuff. So he really went through some trenches to figure out how to pave his way through there. Finally then got a job as a full-time mason's apprentice. So mason's apprentice is pretty much the guy that's mixing up the mortar, carrying the bricks, not really a glorious job. Learned that, worked his way up. Somebody then pulled him aside, saw some potential in him, said, hey, if you really want to make something of yourself, make sure that you learn English, make sure that you learn physics, make sure that you learn math. Study all of that because then you'll know construction inside and out. You can read the drawings. You can then run the job site and then some. And so he did just that. He put himself through school, self-taught, mentors, all of the above, worked his way up to job foreman. And after 40, 50 plus years, I think, in the service, he retired as what they call inspector of works. So he was overseeing the East African railways and harbors. So that was East Africa at that time, Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania. All three countries. So he was pretty good in terms of what he did. My uncle then, my eldest uncle, became an architect in training, trained in London, worked in London. And my father's an engineer. So somewhere in all of it is some blood running in me to be a craftsman, a carpenter, hands-on, creative. And I think that's just sort of how I grew up, putting Legos together. I took apart every single toy that I ever had to figure out how it works. Some of them made it back together. Some of them just didn't. I would take apart my bike. I would take apart the lawnmower. I would, you know, just really interested in how things worked, and became kind of good with my hands. And then my brother is actually a really talented artist, fine artist, drawing, painting, sort of all the art medium. And I learned a lot from him growing up. He's my elder brother. And so I was had this balance between sort of practical and arts and creativity and all of that. And luckily had really great mentors who saw that in me and pushed me towards architecture.
That's one of the most fascinating stories about how somebody became an architect and became interested in the profession. And it also, it's just so interesting to think, because I could meet you and be like, oh, there's a guy from Liberty Township, but it's fascinating to think about all of the things that had to connect for you to end up where you are, and for me to end up where I am, and for us to end up working together and doing a podcast together. So I just always think that's so fascinating. So you graduated from Washington University, you said, and then you entered into the workforce. Talk a little bit about your journey in the workforce before you started your firm.
Well, Washington University is not the most economical path to take for education. I was lucky enough to score a decent scholarship in conjunction with work study. And it was the plan of like, all right, work study is going to help me sort of pay my bills and get through school. And through a lottery system at WashU, I was selected somehow, you know, maybe randomly, maybe it was somehow skill set, who knows. But first day, it said on my little card, shop monitor. And I'm thinking like hall monitor type thing, like super nerdy, super dorky. I don't want to do this. And my buddy was like, does that say shop monitor? And I was like, yeah, whatever that means, you know. And he was like, no, man, that's cool. That's like the wood shop, the metal shop. And I'm like, whoa, really? That's amazing. Let me do that. And so I got into really early first day. Well, actually, even before school started, the first week of like orientation, I was trained by graduate students, seniors, and the facilities manager of the architecture school in the wood shop, the metal shop, and everything. So I learned how to weld right away. I learned how to basically fabricate whatever I needed, because as a shop monitor, you got to be able to help anybody who comes into that shop, whether it's a faculty member, whether it's a grad student or whatever. And I was a freshman in undergrad, learned those skills. I think that more than anything started paving the way for me to think three-dimensionally, think about every single detail in a design and fabrication, learn the processes, learn how hard it is, how to make a mistake, and then fix the mistake, or work with a mistake that you've made, you know, because like if you only have a certain amount of material, you cut it the wrong way, then you go, okay, well, what do I do with this now? And had a 4 solid years doing that. And then actually in graduate school, I got lucky again and did it again. And that by that time, we had introduced digital processes and laser cutting and 3D modeling and 3D printing and all that other stuff that comes with it. So early on, the idea of putting things together in the environment of a design school was very much there. And the other thing about the education was it wasn't just architecture. It was a very much a liberal arts education. So, I mean, women's studies, African studies, civil rights, geology, philosophy, all of the sort of liberal arts classes that others take, the humanities classes that others take, other majors, were all there in addition to a very, very rigorous architectural program alongside, like the architecture school was next to the graphic designers, the fashion designers, the sculptors, the painters. And so every day walking through classroom to classroom, you know, in between studio and all that, we would have an amazing mix between the creative professions, the creative sort of arts, all the way to the engineering, all the way to the business school. I mean, it was an amazing sort of 4 years of shaping my worldview in an architectural sense, meaning for me, architecture is literally everything. Every single thing somehow relates to architecture. And I think I got lucky with, after school, the individuals that I was working with, the firms that I was hired by. Right away, right out of school, I worked for this older architect, Ralph Wafer, in St. Louis, who had a really old office in this old abandoned warehouse on the 7th floor. And you'd enter the building and, you know, typical sort of Midwestern city where some buildings are partially or mostly vacant, abandoned. He was this sort of lone office on the 7th floor after he had been there for so many years. He was still there. You walk into the building, the lobby is kind of cool. You go up, you get to, you know, the elevator and everything worked, but you get to the floor, lights are off, nothing works. It looked abandoned. And then you find his office door and it was like kind of put together. It was really nice. And you open it up and this old, it like took me back to maybe the 50s or 60s. There wasn't a single computer in the office. Everything was hand-drawn. This is in 2002. Everything is hand-drawn, pencil on vellum, an actual diazo machine to make blueprints, literal blueprints, and working on an old desk that was a door on sawhorses. So it was very much like the studio environment, the sort of raw architectural educational studio environment in a workplace. And I loved it. And like I said, everything was hand drawn. So you had to figure it out. You had to know what you're doing. You had to lay it all out. Because if you got it wrong, you had to erase your whole sheet and start over. There was no delete button. There was no copy paste. It was true architecture, learning from the ground up. And two solid years of that was, I think, the most formative education I could have received.
Interesting. So you went from that place at Washington University where you're working with like the top technology available in architecture. You have your CNC machines and all of that and computer software. And then you come here and you're brought back to like the traditional basics of architecture. I think that's probably a great lesson.
And then the firm right after that, I left St. Louis, and Ralph actually helped me write my fix my resume, write my cover letter, write my responses when I got an offer to firms in Connecticut. So it was like true mentor that was actually proud that I was leaving his office and sort of, you know, quote unquote graduating to the next level. You don't find that very often. You find more of a cutthroat sort of selfish mentality with individuals nowadays. And so he just came from this old school, really selfless and serving mentality that really helped shape me, I think, as a person, as an architect. And so what I was going to say is the next firm that I worked for, starting in New Haven, it was the other opposite of the spectrum. Everything was in CAD or Rhino, actually, back then. And I worked alongside with, I was the youngest guy in the office of architects, seasoned architects that were at least 15, 20 years my seniors. And so they really, all of them, five of them, took me underneath their wing. One was amazing at detailing, so I learned how to detail. One was super awesome at design development, so I learned how to push through design. One was the principal, and he was just good at everything, but he was really down to earth, really fun to work with. So he kind of just grounded us that no matter how stressful it got, no matter how hard things were, he never let life be too serious. You know, he understood the greater happiness to things. And actually, he left when the Indonesian tsunami, which was like 2005 or six, around there, he left the firm for a month to go serve over there, and he helped build bridges and houses and an entire sort of village while he was gone, using his architectural skills. And that was also really inspiring too, to just see a principal of ours really use architecture, in my opinion, in the right way to really help make the world a better place. So yeah, that was an awesome experience, because it was there are a few other guys. One guy actually rewrote AutoCAD for the office. He literally wrote our custom routines and plugins, which back in 2005 they didn't exist in AutoCAD, and now the 2020 2021 versions of AutoCAD have some of those routines that I don't know if they took him from him or they just realized that that's what we need, but he was way ahead of the game. That's the point. And learning how to reprogram CAD to make it a tool, make it something that was super useful, making our drawings beautiful back then, adding, you know, fun people, fun trees, fun cars, you know, like really enjoying the process of AutoCAD and the process of drawing again in a very different way, right? So the first job was hand drawing, hand drafting, learning how to do that as an art form, looking up like the old Frank Lloyd Wright drawings, hand drawn, looking up Green and Green architects from the early 1900s, the true craftsman type of drawing. So like just looking at their drawings, you're inspired. You know, the final product is amazing, but the process was amazing as well. And I think that's something that carried through from the first firm to the second firm. And to this day, I mean, you know, because you're on our team, and very proud to have Roger on our team. Let me just give you a little shout out here.
Honored to be a part of it. Chatrick Art.
But I think that's the thing that stays true to today, that the drawing of architecture, the process of architecture, the designing of architecture should be fun, should be enjoyable, should be, you know, at the end of the day, it shouldn't be dictated necessarily by deadline and bottom line, to where everybody on the team is stressed out just trying to get it done and go home by five. It should be an enjoyable process, even if it's from eight, you know, 9 to 5. You should still enjoy your 9 to 5.
I 100% agree. And I think that the unfortunate thing I witness way too often in our profession, especially it starts with school, and we're so obsessed with grades and competitiveness. But at the end of the day, that's not what it really matters. It's not the competitive part. It's about helping people and helping one another. So I'm very on board with that belief and how you approach that perspective.
Thank you.
While you're working with all these different firms, in the back of your mind, are you always thinking, like, I would love to have my own practice one day?
Well, they groomed me for that. You know, the first architect I was working for, there was in our heyday, four individuals in the office. So mostly it was myself and him, myself and Ralph, you know. And so 65-year-old guy with a 22-year-old kid, mm-hmm. Getting trained, learning the ropes, kind of just really fumbling around. He taught me every part of the business. I had to work on everything that he was working on. I had to learn everything that he was doing. I had to just, you know, involve myself in all aspects of the business, really. And he was very transparent with it all, which I really appreciate. I mean, I only made $10 an hour. It was nothing. It was like very meager living, but, and sometimes I didn't even work 40 hours a week because he just didn't have the work. But for two solid years, I got an amazing amount of training, an amazing amount of experience. You know, when I wasn't necessarily working on billable stuff, I was rearranging or organizing the library or the office or, you know, his drawings. And so I would take that time to learn the materials, open up his drawings from like 20 years, 15 years back, and kind of just see how he did it and really soak up the graphics, the information, the layout on the sheet, just the way that drawings should be done. And then the next firm that I worked with, they just kind of taught me so many aspects of the business, and I was just constantly getting solid feedback as in, the types of you're right where you need to be, type of feedback that I just knew. All right. Well, it gave me the confidence. Let me say, it gave me the confidence to know that, if anything happened, I could do this on my own, not on my own, but, as a leader, of a firm. And so through graduate school, because I had some solid work experience before I went to graduate school, I used my graduate school experience, my classes, everything I did, to really delve into theory, into creativity, into all these other aspects, because I wasn't bogged down by the technicalities of architecture. I understood building systems. I understood structure. I understood all of the sort of constraints that you have to work around. So as a student, I think I had quite a head start in that regard for graduate school. And so I, kind of explored what I wanted to explore in graduate school. And so I came out of graduate school saying, all right, I'm ready. Do I work for somebody, or do I do this on my own? And I think just the struggles of the last 10 years of this country, the 12 years of economic struggle and recession and all that, I graduated right in the midst of the worst economy ever.
Oh boy.
Which isn't unlike people who are graduating like today or have graduated within the last year. They're experiencing very similar thing where, the workforce is just struggling, or firms are laying off people and it's just tough out there right now. So very, very lucky that I was confident enough to just kind of start, not unlike yourself, Roger, right? So you found yourself with an opportunity to carve your own path for a little while. And I think all of those types of that entrepreneurial spirit, that confidence, that'll get you far.
Appreciate that. Definitely. It is one of the most unique times in history just to be alive in, but also to be an architect in, because I feel like I don't know if I would be where I am right now without the pandemic and all these people wanting to build additions and realizing that the reality is they're probably going to be stuck in their house for some time. So that was fascinating and a critical part of me starting my own firm in that sense. My next question for you is, how did you end up choosing Cincinnati to start your firm?
All through school, if you look at the master architects, if you look at and study those who are most successful with architecture, more often than not, there's always exceptions, but more often than not, they're practicing architecture in the environments that they know best, in their sort of, it's not home, it's where they live, and that's where they start anyway, until they sort of explode as starchitects and mm-hmm. work across the world. But that always intrigued me, and I always struggled because Liberty Township or Westchester or Cincinnati or even Ohio, from a certain point of view, is not the most interesting place to be. But perhaps that's the mentality of, well, I was born here and I know this place more than any other place. And so maybe that's how I feel because I've grown up here where, if you landed me in the cornfields of, Finland, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But if you landed me in just some sort of everyday area in any part of the world, just by nature, I would feel, or by definition, it would be exotic to me, right? And I would be like, ooh, this is a barn in Germany, this is great. Mm-hmm. Whereas, so I think at the end of the day, you always wrestle between where's the most interesting place and your home. You always wrestle between your environment and architecture. We're trained to see, right? We're trained to hear. We're trained to sort of take our sensory perceptions and absorb the information that we need to manifest architecture, to really shape the environment, to create space. And I think I learned that I don't have to go somewhere, quote unquote, exotic. I can go back to the place that I know best. I can bring good design here. I can bring good ideas here. I can develop solid architecture and maybe help put Cincinnati, I don't want to say put Cincinnati on the map or back on the map, because I mean, there is a great architectural history here, but there's also a terrible architecture history here in some ways.
Very right? Profit driven.
So I would love to, you know, I don't remember going around as a child looking at buildings and thinking, wow, I want to be an architect because I was inspired by the architecture. I was never inspired by architecture as a kid. I was inspired by life. I was inspired by experience and other things. And I thought many times, this is boring. This building is boring. This environment is boring. And so I'd have to find my inspiration in other things. And so when I went to school, when I went around the world, when I traveled, and I saw, you know, the work of Alvar Aalto in Finland, when I saw the work of Luis Barragán in Mexico, when I saw the work of Enrique Miralles in Barcelona, or Libeskind in Berlin, you know, or Frank Gehry in Barcelona as well. When I saw all of those masterpieces of architecture, where you actually feel a difference between one space and another. You feel how the architecture affects you as a person. It affects the people. It affects how people move and walk and react to themselves, to the building, to their environment. Bringing all of that back here, I mean, that's the inspiration. How can we bring that here? And I don't think that I'm necessarily like, I often come at things in a very lofty, inspirational sort of message. I think that's just me, but I don't want to claim at all that I have any answer that's better than someone else. As my fellow architects that are listening, or architects that are training that are listening, but I believe that we all have that responsibility to make the world a better place, to beautify the environment, to really bring design into areas of the world, into neighborhoods of Cincinnati, into corners and pockets that design doesn't necessarily reach, and lift up every single part of Cincinnati. Black neighborhoods, brown communities, white communities, rural, everything, wherever it is, bring a sense of that capital A architecture into, you know, the barns of Ohio, the farmhouses of Ohio, the beautiful parts of Ohio, the music halls, right? Like, I mean, everything that's, there's so much potential here to really make this world a better place. And I think that's my why.
Yeah, that's a beautiful goal, and I'm glad to be a part of it. And I'm sure just by people listening to this podcast, by hearing you say that, they're going to be inspired to try to go out and do what you're doing. So you are a trendsetter and an inspiration in that regard. One question I do have for you is, Chotrick is a unique name for an architecture firm. When I generally hear an architecture firm, it's like some three letters put together for somebody's initials. But I'm curious to know where the name Chotrick came from.
So dare I say, it's a bit pretentious to put your letters, your name as the company name. I'm gonna call out all of the architecture firms out there, but I think that's just sort of a it used to be the cool thing, and perhaps it's not anymore. But I feel very selfless towards life, selfless towards architecture. the way that I approach architecture and that I believe that our work should, working with any client, working with every community and lifting up the world, very much in the spirit of Architecture for Humanity, which is no longer around, but it was around for a while with Cameron Sinclair and team. They had a couple of those books released, Design Like You Give a Damn. That's how I design, like I give a damn, because I do. And I don't feel it's appropriate to put my name necessarily as the firm's name. And so what inspires me? The Chautrick. That is a songbird from Eastern mythology. This songbird, the story of the Chautrick is amazing. The story of the Chautrick is something that can inspire anybody. It inspires human life. It's not necessarily architectural, but it's a songbird that had a hole in its beak. The hole allows it to sing super high, super beautifully, and distinct, unique, unlike any other bird. But the hole also prevents it from drinking the water from the ground, from the pools or ponds that other birds drink from. And so it's only able to drink when it rains. Wow. So the story of the Chautrick is this bird, this songbird that was always flying really high up towards the sky with its head pointed up, longing for just kind of having this thirst and desire and longing for just one drop of rain. And it would always say, and the story is that with one drop, my thirst is quenched. With one drop of you, it's a kind of a love story between, you know, the soul and the ultimate soul, between the man and God, between, you know, the creation and the creator, whatever sort of analogy you want to put to it. But that sort of analogy that makes you feel that you are just a part of a huge, huge whole here, and that there's something much, much larger than yourself. And that thing that's larger than yourself, that energy, that entity, that light, whatever it is, that force, is where you can get the most inspiration. And so taking that, the lesson is we shouldn't be like the others. We should always be looking upwards for inspiration. We should strive to look past the everyday and ordinary things and find the sublime, find the beauty, find the meaning of life, find them, and do that every single day, every single moment of every single day. So when you apply that to architecture, that's why it's Chautrick architecture, where we, what is it? Inspire beauty and
deliver excellence.
Deliver excellence.
Well, after hearing all that, I think Channon Design LLC may sound a little boring, and I might. Wow, that was beautiful. Love it. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, Roger, that's what architecture is all about. It really is about capturing the sunlight, capturing sound, or augmenting sound, or dampening sound, really evoking a feeling, you know, because that can be through material, that can be through color, that can be through proportions. In terms of proportions, something that's huge, a grand space, can make you feel a certain way. So think of like St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. St. Peter's, you walk into that thing and it's huge. Just by nature, you feel small. Very similar to the Sagrada Familia in Barcelona. You feel small in these huge cathedrals. But the beautiful part about St. Peter's is there's that single aperture at the top of the dome that brings light inside. And so on a normal sort of hot, sunny, whatever day, you're outside the basilica and you're just kind of like, you don't really pay attention to the sun, or you want to get away from it. You walk into the cathedral and somehow that same light, that beam of light, becomes something sublime, and you just feel in awe of. You feel very inspired. And on the other side of it, like if you walk into a Frank Lloyd Wright building, one of his houses, and it's no joke, he really did size these houses and make the proportions of things perfect for the human scale. it's amazing. You kind of, at some point, you start to measure your own body. You start to feel yourself in a space based on the architecture, and it highlights your own existence. That's what architecture is all about, making you feel alive, making you feel inspired, making you feel like, you know, because life's tough. Life can be really dismal and depressing and dark, you know, all of those other things. That's why people start drinking and doing drugs and, you know, getting angry and kind of losing their way. But I really feel architecture can be one of those things that can, you know, save humanity.
I love that. That is hear that, everybody out there listening. You can save humanity. I think that's awesome. Beautiful. Thank you, Jaipal, for that message.
Have you read The Fountainhead?
I have not.
So it's a cop-out. Any other sort of older architects are going to be like, oh, blah, 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 The Fountainhead by Ayn Rand. The Fountainhead is actually a really amazing story. It's a very fantastical story. It takes hints from Frank Lloyd Wright's life, and creates this character, Howard Roark. And Howard Roark is this amazing architect, and he's kind of battling between the crappy architects and himself. And he's always failing again and again and again because he does not want to allow a shitty building. Can I say that on your podcast?
Yes, you.
He doesn't want to allow like terrible architecture to be built, right? He feels so much pain from a poorly constructed or poorly designed or developed building that he just, he'll just scrap the project, throw away his drawings, and then he'll lose a client or whatever. And it's not until sort of the end of the book or the end of the story as it develops that he starts to really find, after having made mistake after mistake after mistake and preventing those mistakes from actually manifesting and seeing others, his peers, make those mistakes, he finally comes into his own and creates this just amazing, everything that I'm talking about, you know, just this work of architecture that not only inspires, but it redefines what architecture can be. I read that book in a weekend, and typically if you give me a book, it's going to take me a long time to get through it, because I'd rather be outside playing, you know. As a kid, I wasn't really one to sit down and actually get through a book, but I read that thing from like cover to cover because it was just, it was very inspiring. And to this day, again, other people might say it's a cop out to be inspired by that very fantastical story, but I loved it. And I highly recommend to anybody The Fountainhead.
Okay. Well, we'll put that on our said architecture and interior design podcast reading list. Love it. Did they make a movie after that too? Is that a movie?
They probably did, but I wouldn't. I think that's probably the first time I would say read the book, don't watch the movie. I'm totally a movie first, book second guy. But in that one, you got to read the book. You cannot watch the movie. If there is, there probably is a movie.
I feel like that story was too familiar to me. Like I know I didn't read the book, but I feel like there may have been a movie. But don't watch the movie. Read the book to anybody listening. So
there's a.
So you start your practice. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the initial challenges you are facing and how you've been able to overcome them and just where you are now as a firm?
Officially, we started 3 years, 3.5, 4 years ago, 2017. But unofficially, been working towards it very informally, moonlighting on the side, freelancing early on. Even before I was licensed, not unlike yourself. But, you know, kind of growing into it, playing around with what it means to have a firm, not really being super serious about it, through several years. Got very serious about it in 2017, did all the sort of business things you need to be doing, got the legs of the business going. The first year was all about testing myself. Is this the right decision? 'Cause I left the best job I ever had, the best position I ever had, the best money I was ever making, the best team I was ever with, you know, it was like literally the highlight of my career. But I just had this burning desire that, like, if I don't leave now, if I don't start now, maybe I never will. And I don't want to regret. And so I started, and the first year was all about testing, is this the right decision? Kind of, am I able to get projects? Are people reacting to me or reacting to the business in a positive way that they want to work with the business? Is this a firm that, you know, will survive? And dare I say, making a lot of mistakes in that first year, a lot of mistakes, with clients, with projects, with, not on a technical thing that would put me in trouble, you know, legally or anything like that, but just for myself, how to handle relationships, how to handle, projects, how to handle deadlines, how to handle money, that sort of thing of just learning the business. The second year was, all right, I'm not going to make any mistakes or those mistakes. I'm going to learn from those mistakes and build and, got the business on solid footing, but I was still working for myself. And I still had, if I had a team that I was working with, they weren't full time. It was very much part time, helper bees throughout. You know, I had a kind of building my network, working with individuals. The third year was, all right, if I want this thing to work, I need a solid team. I need a network of people. And I need full time individuals that are working with me. And so by then, by the third year, I got the business up on its legs, and I built the team. And ironically, that was through while COVID hit in the middle of that third year. But I didn't let that stop me. I kind of through that month of when the world, the entire world, was like shut down, and the environment started coming back, and places that hadn't seen birds or animals for a long time have started to see, you know, greenery and lush and all that. During that moment, I kind of used that as inspiration and said, all right, I'm going to double down on the business. I'm going to double down and invest. I'm going to double down and kind of take a chance, hire people, because I started to see people getting laid off and individuals that I had known through the network being available and keeping in touch with individuals and also seeing opportunities in the architectural world. So while, you know, everybody who's listening to this now knows certain sectors were hit pretty hard and very much struggled, but other sectors of architecture thrived through the pandemic. And so being able to have your finger on the pulse, being able to, you know, ear on the ground, really paying attention to what was happening in the world was important as a businessman. And you know, there's a certain point of, like I said, I'm not bogged down by the technicality of architecture, mm-hmm. No matter what project it is. If something new, something huge, something whatever it is, I really don't feel daunted by architecture or the complicated part of it. That will figure out, that will have. What I really invested in is myself learning business. How do other fields do it? You know, lawyers, doctors, insurance people, like all the sort of other businesses of the world. How do entrepreneurs really succeed? How do they work? And so reading those types of books is very important. Books on finances, books on money, books on just sort of HR development, culture, people. Books on self-help, sort of philosophy of what's the mindset that you need to have. Books on discipline. You know, even there's many books that relate to, you know, the military and the sort of discipline that soldiers have towards their craft and their mentality with sort of a lifetime. If you think about, you know, older seasoned military individuals, they wake up every day at the same time, they make their bed, they, you know, they have their meals at a certain time, they have a regular exercise routine, their life itself is very disciplined, and therefore they succeed. So I took a lot of those sort of cues, mm-hmm. and jump-started the business in in through everything that isn't architecture, if you will.
Very interesting. And I'd like to go back to one thing you said. You talked about a lot of different sectors of architecture. You have industrial, commercial, residential, the big ones I just listed. But a lot of firms will confine themselves to certain niches in the architectural profession. Like some firms will just specialize in industrial. You seem to be very willing to pursue any kind of project, big or small, any kind of opportunity, even if they're in different sectors. And from what I've been able to observe, that has helped you a lot. Do you think you will continue to spread your wings out far, or do you want to sort of confine your specialties into various sectors?
I think our specialty as a firm is solid design, good design, beautiful design, inspirational design. That can happen in any sector. As a businessman, there are many pluses to specializing, to focusing your marketing down to a certain clientele, to a certain sector, because once you become an expert in one thing, people see you as that way, and then you're their go-to. And, you know, so from a business strategy standpoint, there's a lot of merit to doing something like that. But ultimately, I don't want to, definitely don't want to be a one-trick pony. And having seen right out of undergrad was the dot-com bubble burst. And so, we were in a recession then. Right out of grad school was the economic recession, the Great Recession. And, you know, here we are 10 years later with COVID. So it's like every 10 years or so, there's this really huge dip in the economy. And I've seen my peers, friends, colleagues, people I've worked with that just drop off the workforce. And it's been so bad that many of them have left architecture because it's just been too tough. It's been something that hasn't been sort of left a good taste in their mouth. And a lot of firms collapse as well because they weren't able to adapt and be nimble. And I think the other side of it, as a good businessman, to be able to be nimble and adapt for whatever situation comes our way. So if it's a childcare facility, yes, let's do it. If it's a senior housing, yes, let's do it. If it's a hotel, all over it. Restaurant, retail, somebody's residence, you know, grandma passed away and grandpa needs to move in, so let's build an addition. All right, let's do it, you know. Or, you know, we have way too much money for our own good and we want to just renovate the entire house or build a new house, you know, because we have the money to do it. All right, let's do it. Whatever, you know, or a veterinarian's office. We're actually in conversation right now with a local veterinarian that needs to expand their dental and surgical rooms for dogs and cats, and like totally weird project, but we're all in, you know, so let's do it. And then there's another one that's a church up in Dayton that we're trying to figure out how to start that project. But, you know, it, all over the gamut. You've worked with us long enough now that you've heard me talk about, you know, the donut shop, the pizza shop, the housing addition. It's
the bakery.
The bakery. I mean, there's so many different things that we work on, and I love that. You know, from day to day, or week to week, or month to month, having that variety, I know is important to me because I can't work on the same thing over and over. But certain people can. Certain people love that. But I think it makes for a fun firm. So we're only, you know, technically 3+ years young. So let's see where it develops and if we end up becoming a specialty. But, you know, would love to do parkscapes and landscapes and urban environments and, you know, kind of build out from there. So there's a lot of work out there. There's a huge world and a lot of opportunity to make Cincinnati, to make Ohio, to make the U.S., to make the globe a better place. So we're all in.
Love that. Now, our main listener base here at the said Architecture and Interior Design podcast is young professionals such as myself just getting out into the workforce, or even people just starting architecture school. Do you have any advice that you would give to somebody young just starting their career that you wish somebody had told you early on, or that you've learned, or somebody told you. And you're like, that's great.
I would say be patient, first and foremost. Patience is something that's slowly dwindling from our culture, from society. But it's very important as an architect to have patience, to also have a kind of patience, and perseverance are the two things. Perseverance, patience is like, you know, you don't necessarily need to be the principal of your firm right away. You don't need to be the manager of anything right away. You know, have patience, learn the profession, learn what architecture is. Have patience with yourself making mistakes, have patience with your clients, have patience with the design process. Don't rush to the design process. You know, design can't happen when you're pissed off or, you know, negative or depressed or gloomy day or feeling sick. You know, it doesn't really, it's not that inspiring when you're feeling stressed. Design and creativity happens and comes out and flows out of positivity, period. And so that requires patience. Sometimes when you put things in a pressure cooker, you know, you come out with a pretty cool outcome. But that's not what I'm talking about. Over your career, having patience. Perseverance, on the other hand, is about enduring, having that stamina to see a project all the way through. Ducking and weaving with economic constraints or client requests or changes or, you know, a number or city, you know, responses or comments that are coming back and you have to change things or a certain design didn't work out, so you got to figure it out again. Persevering through the project from start to finish will lead to good design. As long as you're pushing for good design. Architecture is never done, even when it's done. There's always an opportunity to improve it, especially when it's not built yet, right? So at the very stage of early stages of a project, yeah, you can, you know, come up with a cool design, come up with a cool idea, kind of cook it, bake it, get it developed, bring it to fruition with construction documents. But if at that point it needs to change, be nimble, be flexible, and be humble enough. You know, that's probably the other thing. Patience, perseverance, and humility. There, those are my three lessons. Patience, perseverance, humility. But be humble enough that you can change it. You're not like, damn it, this is my design. Me, that you're able to, you're confident enough, you're good enough, you're creative enough to come up with another idea, right? I mean, people get pissed off when they feel a little bit threatened or insecure. You know, so have that security in yourself, that confidence in yourself, but be humble enough to be able to change things. I think more than anything, those three things are probably the most important. And I'm seeing a lot of architects, a lot of younger professionals that don't have that patience. They don't have that perseverance, and they're certainly not humble enough to like work with or deal with. You know, they'd rather jump ship, find something else, than kind of work through. So if a particular environment isn't exactly what you want in your office, work through it, figure it out. Don't just abandon it and kind of leave. Kind of work through it, figure out why it's not working. Figure out what the problem really is so that, you know, if in fact the right decision is to leave and move on, you know why you've done that. You know why, and you've kind of explored all of those relationships, all of the sort of environment that you're in that you know, and you can kind of learn from it and grow from it. So again, patience with yourself to develop into an architect, perseverance for the client, for yourself, for the design to melt, to develop. And I think everybody should just be humble.
I love that, Jai Paul. Thank you. I think there was a lot of listeners right now that just looked in on themselves and was like, I need to be more patient. I think definitely we can all work on that at times. So excellent advice. I really appreciate it. We're almost out of time here, but I just wanted to leave the final word with you. Do you have any other messages you want to share with our listeners before we end?
I would have you Well, thank you. Let me say thank you, Roger, for what you're doing. I think this is very unique to have somebody who isn't quite an architect yet to start off in one of the, you know, you're doing this for everybody, but you're also understanding that the best way to learn architecture is to talk to some architects, gain a wide variety of experience from each other. And I think that's awesome. You know, just keep doing that. Architecture is a team sport. It's very collaborative. It requires all of us, you know, to be in it together. So I don't feel like there's any competition. There is friendly competition here and there for, you know, buy-in for projects. But at the end of the day, we should all be working to beautify and help and uplift and, you know, recreate what Cincinnati can be, and the world. So not just Cincinnati, but, you know, since we're here talking about Cincinnati. I think, you know, what you're doing is really important for all of us, pushing the conversation of what architecture is, pushing the conversation of four Cincinnati architects. And I think you're going to go pretty far in this profession.
Well, I appreciate that.
As long as you stay patient.
I definitely need to work on that sometimes. Got me there. Well, I really appreciate it, Jaipal, and this was excellent. I learned so much, and I'm sure everybody listening did, and for that we are very grateful and appreciative, and hopefully we'll have you back on the podcast and sometime in the future, and you can tell us about your cool Starkitect projects that you've done that inspire beauty and deliver excellence.
I'm very grateful to your support, Roger, and anybody who wants to join the Chatrick team, please visit the website, get in touch with me. I'd love to, you know, talk to anybody and have coffee or tea, either virtually or in person after everything is cleared up here. But we're a welcoming team that wants to join hands with the city here. So,
excellent. I will leave a link to Chatrick's website in the podcast description, just so everybody does know, and any other links Jaipal gives me. Thanks, Jaipal. Have a great day, everyone, and thanks for listening.